All right, let's begin. My name is David Mazenbring, and this session is called How Maritime Ministry Can Help Your Church. I was tempted to say save your church. That might be a little too pessimistic about the state of the church. But I will, although it'll take a little while to unfold, I will try and make a case that I think more than most social service ministries of the church, this one offers rich dividends to the people who practice it and to their church communities. I know about this because my wife and I spent 15 years from 91 to 2006 establishing a new maritime ministry in Fort Lauderdale's seaport called Seafarer's House, or Casa del Marino, bilingual name. We started off by sharing one full-time position, and when we left there were 35 employees, so it had grown into what was actually the largest, it wasn't the largest budget among maritime ministries, but we had more seafarers walking through our doors than any other maritime ministry in the world, so we were very proud of that. The best way I know to launch into it, actually, is by sharing with you a PBS portrait that was done with Maria and me right before we left for the Visionaries. And in 12 minutes, you can get a lot of orientation. So I don't generally do a lot of media in my presentations, but this one is too compact and too well told a story to not take advantage of it. So Eric, you want to punch the power button for me? Thank you. And when we see blue.
Something's coming out there.
Yep, it's coming out. Kathleen, do you mind to get the lights over there? Are they out? Maybe they're out here.
There they are.
Okay.
We are going to take you into an invisible world to meet the men and women who toil below the decks of cruise liners and the ships that carry most of the goods that fuel the global economy. They are a proud lot. There is something noble in their quiet commitment to home and family, in their brave pursuit of a better life. Often they arrive in port lonely and desperate to connect with their families. For more than 180 years, seafarer missions have been helping this invisible population in ports around the world. We go now to just one of them. It is Seafarer's House in Port Everglades, Florida. It is taking this ancient tradition of compassion and caring for travelers in a foreign land to a new level with a spirit of entrepreneurialism.
Ancient practice began way back in the very beginning of the 1800s. In fact, the word strike comes from seafaring because they struck the sails and refused to sail because conditions were so bad.
This is an important port for cruise ships as well as cargo ships. Maybe we have container ships. On cargo ships, you have this number of
crew members, an average of 20. On cruise ships,
you might have even 1,500 crew members.
So
life is very different.
We never see them, we never think about them, but most of our consumer goods come from abroad and they are brought by ship, sometimes under very dangerous conditions.
A huge amount of our economy travels by sea on a ship at a human cost. Someone's got to leave their family.
There might be a different kind of loneliness. The loneliness you might experience among to many people, the loneliness you might feel in New York, surrounded with people and yet alone, or the loneliness of being just by yourself.
Originally, I think it was primarily an activity to convert the heathen seafarers to Christianity. And then little by little, it became a social service ministry of the church. It grew rapidly, especially in this country, in the middle of the 1800s. And there were, at one point, probably 20 different seafaring agencies in New York City alone.
I tried to figure out once how many times a seafarer sails in and out of Port Everglades. About 1 million times a year, a human being working on a cargo or a cruise ship sails in and out of Port Everglades. That's a lot of strangers to welcome, as Christian, Jewish, and Muslim scriptures call us to do.
Seafarers were very much marginalized people.
Seafarers come from a lot of different countries. They're away from their homes for extended times. They come into port and they're really interested in connecting with their family. They communicate with their family on the telephone, or maybe send money home, or just have some R&R.
I'm from Honduras. Some small village named Bruce Lagoon.
Okay, I'm from Panama. In port, we always stay more or less 20 hours, no more.
Me, I have four kids, two boys and two girls. But I have one boy and another girl adopted after the hurricane passed.
Seafarers get paid in US dollars, and they need a safe and reliable way to send the money to their families. That's why they're working on the ship, to support and provide an opportunity to enhance their lives and to send the kids to school and pay the medical bills.
The crew come here not for a sense of adventure, as maybe was the romantic view of the past. They come to support their families, their loved ones. The only reason they leave their loved ones is because this is the best ticket to better economic opportunity.
I'm just looking to get better life. I mean, to give better life to my kids, my wife, my family.
That's the main concern, the families. It's all around the families. That's the reason they're here, the sacrifice.
Right now, about 13,000 times a year, a crew member walks into Seafarer's House here and transfers an average of about $500 each time. I think it's really important that when somebody walks in with that $500 and wants to send it to their wife so she can have an operation that she urgently needs, that more than a simple exchange of dollars through a bulletproof glass window takes place, as might happen down the street.
I think when they come and look at me, it's like they look at a familiar face, probably.
I think it's really important for the seafarers that they feel it's really a safe place where they are out of their work environment and they can say what's on their mind, communicate whatever needs they have. And by returning that, I think we bring them closer to our heart, and the closer you are to our heart, the closer you are to the faith and belief in God. And I think it doesn't matter which religion you have, it's all the same to me. And I think the seafarers sense that.
And yes, they release all the words or opinions they have, what they do with the ship, and if they're not happy, they're tired being away from home for 10 months a year.
And I have a high respect for the seafarers because they are self-sacrificing, they give up their lives for the lives of those who they love. They provide education for their children, they provide hospital care for their aging parents, they build homes, they lend money, they really are the source of wealth for an extended community.
Now we are heading for the West of Damme. The West of Damme is one of the Holland America line. The people that work on the ships that have to send their money orders home for their families, They want to buy the toothpaste and the shaving cream, and they can play pool in Casa del Marino.
They can pay, like, I would say, a cook, about $900 a month. $900 is a lot of money for them. They send usually all of the money. Besides to support the family, they want to build a house. Or they start a new business.
Sunday is a very busy place in this port with lots of cruise ships. So these crew are arriving off the cruise ships. They've got a very narrow window of time in which to call home, buy their supplies, send their money home, and they all come at once.
What we do here is to provide them with the basics, the toiletries, the enemy foods that they find enjoyable. This is sweet pork, eggplant, omelette. This is the milkfish from back home, from the Philippines. You know, once a week, they can taste something from back home. Then they're happy.
Some of the more progressive grant making in this country 15 years ago was thinking along the lines of how nonprofits could better sustain themselves by involving themselves in the economy of the people that they work with. If we don't have 1,000 people go through Seafarer's House today, then our economy is going to fall apart. That keeps us loyal to the interests of the crew, as opposed to some grant maker sitting in an office in New York. The proceeds from the sale of these products is not only going to help them, but it helps us too. It helps us pay for our bills, keep the building open, so that today they're buying tastes of home, but the results of that also keep our building open, keep our staff here, so that if they get in trouble and need more than a taste of home, we're here to help them that way too. When I got here, I looked at where are people spending their money, and it was on phone calls. And I said, is that something we can feel good about helping them do and do more efficiently and perhaps earn a small margin if we do it in huge volume?
So these are the phones. They have a little bit more privacy, and sometimes they need to express their feelings and they don't want to be seen. So they get their votes. There needs to be a linkage with the home and with the family.
And having traveled a lot, I knew about the concept of phone cards, which were not popular in the United States yet. And I thought, we should start a phone card for these people. And I'm very proud that Seafarer's House operates today the oldest phone card in the maritime industry. That's how we built a network among 70 chaplains in 65 ports scattered throughout the United States and Canada.
Marie and David just, I think, have always just kept a very clear respect for each other and their roles. Being a husband and wife team, you know that can be sometimes difficult.
I always like to say that Maria founded this ministry before she found and married me. So when people say, how did I get involved? I say, I married into it.
As I respect Maria so much for what she does for the seafarers and their acceptance of her, David's been instrumental in bringing an entrepreneurial.
So it kind of deteriorates from there into
We don't get to see the credits.
Pardon me?
We don't get to see the credits?
No. The rest of the program, I mean, the filmmaker who came really took an interest in the whole issue of how nonprofits struggle to survive their founders. So we were the purpose of this session is to talk a little bit about how Maritime Ministry can help your church, so you don't really need to know the stuff about us leaving Seafarer's House. We were there. Your responses. What surprised you the most?
Well, it didn't surprise me, but it's so wonderful to see that the sense of missionary conversion is a thing of the past. You know, I know all denominations, and still I'm sure some denominations are doing that, trying to make everybody into a good Christian. Or usually not just a good Christian, they want them to be of their particular persuasion, right. You know. I'm so glad that you're beyond that. And
So that raises a question. I mean, the churches that do maritime ministry the strongest are the Anglicans who started it. It started in the 1800s as an evangelical outreach. There was this whole missionary movement in England to save the souls of heathens in Africa, for example. And some people said, well, the souls of these hard living seafarers on our doorstep are in pretty bad shape. Why don't we reach out to them? So it began as an evangelical outreach. Today, there are really two camps in the maritime ministry world. Those who take the position that we're called to assist in a practical way to meet the needs of people, and that that is a witness of God's love for all God's children, welcoming the stranger. It's there in Matthew 25 as one of the things that at the last day will be held accountable for. I was a stranger and you welcomed me. The groups that do that really in a strong way, the denominations that do it in this country, are the Episcopalians, the Lutherans, and the Catholics. Mm. The Southern Baptists do maritime ministry. The Southern Baptist missions proliferate in ports around the country, and they are more of a sign people up for their stripe of Jesus kind of an approach. Now that doesn't mean we had a chapel at Seafarer's House, and we held worship services. There wasn't a lot of time or demand for that. I mean, there would be on Christmas and Easter, basically. And we would do it on call at other times. I've gone on board ships and done services in the wake of some, you know, at the request of the captain because a crew member has died or because there's big conflict within the crew, that kind of thing. The big piece is counseling. And the biggest sharing of our faith with them is around the counseling issues. People get on those phones and learn that a father's just died, or feel their relationship with their spouse slipping away. A lot of literature. To be honest, and this gets into the realm of why do I think they're doing maritime ministry is good for us and our practice of church?
The, when you say they, you're referring to the Southern Baptists.
No, the seafarers.
Oh, seafarers.
The last sermon, this is one of my parishioners here, or we share a church together, Kathleen. So one of the last sermons I talked about, it was that gospel text of Peter walking on the water to Jesus, remember? And his faith falters and he starts to sink. And I talked about how there's something about the mysteries of the deep and the way wind moves over waters. Mm. That stirs faith in the people who sail those waters. Mm. And it was our experience, Maria and me, that seafarers have a really strong faith. Mm. And when you are engaged in a welcoming of strangers, when you're engaged with people who have strong faith, it helps your faith. Mm. So that's one, thank you for that reaction. Other reactions, what moved you, impressed you?
Universal thing I saw there was a ministry that would be self-supporting or an organization that was not dependent upon grants. And
right.
I had lots of experience watching organizations who had huge parts of their staff basically oriented around achieving the next grant.
Yep.
And not focusing on the need and getting distorted in their thinking because the need didn't lined up with the grant.
Chasing the whims of the grant maker rather than the needs of your crew. I got there because before I came to Florida and started doing that work, I had been a grant maker. I'd been reading grant proposals and making recommendations to a board about which groups to fund. So I was very keenly aware of the dangers of getting dependent on the funder. And we had been encouraging our grantees to develop more of an entrepreneurial model and to engage themselves in the economy of the people they wanted to serve. And you heard me talk there about how at that mission, we were forced to be loyal to the interests of the people we wanted to serve because if we weren't meeting their needs in a high volume way. Now, that doesn't mean that we only provided services that they paid for. In the little advert on the board there, it says that seafarers are the largest group of least protected workers left in our society. And that's really true. The practice over the last 50 years of flagging your ship offshore, U.S. ship owners very rarely fly the U.S. flag anymore, because if they fly a flag of convenience, they escape safety standards, tax laws, and most importantly, labor laws. So you're free to recruit from the global labor pool, and you fly in your crew from wherever they are to meet the ship, put them on board the ship. They sail for a contract of 9 to 12 months, generally, 8 months sometimes. And then you fly them back home. What was it going with that?
Case protected.
And that you're there at your mercy.
So they are at the, those ships are little islands of tyranny, floating islands of tyranny. And they have no, virtually no rights. There's no international labor standards. I mean, there is an international labor organization, but it has no teeth. It sets standards, but it has no enforcement provisions. So and when a ship sails into port, the agent boards the ship. First government boards the ship. First Coast Guard has contact with it. Then U.S. Immigration and Customs comes on board. The ship's agent is on board. And guess what all of these people are concerned about? Well, the immigration is concerned about keeping the crew on the ship, right? And the agent is concerned about the commerce of the ship. The only one who boards the ship with the welfare of the crew in mind are the representatives of the Seafarers Mission. And so we would find that in boarding those ships, we'd train our ship visitors to move around the ship as much as possible and ask everybody you can, is everything okay? Is everything okay? Is everything okay? And to be on the lookout for that crew who looks both ways and then says, can I talk to you later? And it was not unusual. I would say on average once a month, Maria, who did our seafarers' rights work, as well as the pastoral counseling stuff, once a month she would encounter crew who were owed back wages. And if we had more time, I'd tell very dramatic stories about a whole crew that had been denied their wages for maybe 6 months. Because if you think about it, you are working on a ship thousands of miles from home. You sail into port. The owner is maybe off in Greece somewhere, or God knows where. The agent comes on board your ship and says, well, the good news is the owner wired me money to reprovision your galley, but he didn't send me any money for your wages. So what are you going to do? I mean, your best bet is to sail to the next port and hope that the wages are in that next port. And you sail to the next port, and you sail to the next port. And pretty soon, you have no cash left. We have rescued, Maria has rescued crew members who were stranded on the dock in Haiti and had no way out of that country. Because by the time they woke up to the fact that they're never going to get paid, they had no means left for getting home, and extremely difficult for a crew member who leaves home in order to support the family to call the family and say, send me money so that I can go home. Sometimes they do that, but that's really tough.
Wow. Is there a competitive market for those workers, meaning if a ship owner is developing a reputation of not paying as agreed, that ship owner would find fewer and fewer applicants for those positions?
Not necessarily, because you can recruit. I mean, maybe you get a reputation in one country, so you just start recruiting from another country. It's a big world. And the people who are being recruited, really, it's a lottery. They have no idea what kind of employer they're going into. They find a good one, they may sign up over and over for that one. That's mostly in the cargo industry, but I have seen cruise ships fail and hundreds of crew be stuck on board, owed wages. Generally, the cruise industry is a little bit better as far as meeting basic standards of providing health care and paying wages on time. The cruise ships that are whose economy is falling apart, they tend to be the small ones. But I have seen them fall apart, and the crew gets stranded, and it's the port chaplain who is in a unique position at that point, learn about the problem, to get assistance, whether it's on the practical basis. One, we had a ship stuck in port. Russian crew and Vietnamese, Russian officers and Vietnamese crew members owed 6 months of back wages once. And one of our functions during the protracted period of trying to get them their back pay and repatriated back home, one of our functions was simply to go to the to go to the local video store several times a week and get videos, because the crew are stuck on this ship in this port with nothing to do. Day after day, week after week, month after month, and it drives them crazy. We give them free phone calls home to their family too, that kind of thing. So the as the ears and eyes of looking out for the welfare of the crew, it's huge. Now there's no money in that, from speaking from an entrepreneurial point of view, but you don't see that from every ship every day. So the model we developed was, what's the basic needs of most of the crew that we can try and provide on a daily basis, so that we have a relationship with all the crew who come into this port, and then when they fall through the cracks because of a problem, they know where to turn for help. Mm. And I think it's a good model. It's curious that churches often think they can't or shouldn't charge money to their clients, that's getting their hands dirty. And I took a lot of hits from a lot of people who, including in the maritime ministry world, who really thought that I was just a businessman, not a ministry leader, for setting it up in that way.
I'm intrigued with the falling through the cracks, David. It's like these folks that are on back wages for 6 months. I don't know how common that occurrence happened for you, but they're there for 2 hours, you know, totally transient in their makeup, and you're dumped. This information, you know, by that guy that looks both ways in your corner and say, what's going on? They go away. You know, I mean, but you're left with this information. Is there another port that you're going to that somebody can catch up with them and say, all right, what's going on? And then in turn, go aboard to find out the latest update.
So this question raises the opportunity for me to talk about the network among port chaplains. The denominational networks are not really very strong. The Catholics have a pretty strong one, and the Southern Baptists have a pretty strong one. I think one of the gifts of maritime ministry to the larger church is its ecumenical practice. It is done best today where it's done ecumenically. And there's an organization in this country, on this continent. It's the North American, Canadian, and U.S., North American Maritime Ministry Association, NAMMA, NAMMA.org. We'll link you to NAMMA. And they hold an annual conference, which is the strongest thing that they do, where port chaplains from around the US and Canada just get together and network and share stories and talk about issues of mutual concern. How do you establish the agency? How do you train ship visitors? How do you fund it, of course? What are common resources for providing religious literature, for example? And it is not uncommon when you see a ship that has problems to identify where it's going next. And even if the crew won't tell you that, or the captain won't tell his crew, and the captain won't tell you, you can generally find out from the Coast Guard if you have good working relationships in your port. And then we've been contacted by port chaplains, and we have contacted port chaplains in other ports ourselves and said, here's, and it may be for what we call a human rights case, like the one you mentioned, or it may be a pastoral case. I spent time with so-and-so on this ship who's really struggling to stay sober, and know that he's headed to your next port, and have his permission to call you and urge you to look for him when he gets there, and just support him in his ongoing struggle. But one of the great, so there's that network. Port chaplains share an itinerant congregation that floats from one port to another. But it is also a great frustration I've counseled people, I counseled one Muslim man, Egyptian, who was scared for his life on a cargo ship. He was the only Muslim on a ship of Catholics from Uruguay, I think, or someplace in Central America. And he was scared for his life. He was afraid he was going to be shoved overboard one night. And we can't make decisions for them. We can walk with them. We can listen to them. We can tell them what resources are available. We can try and network them to chaplains in their next port. Maria would say that often her job was to help them think through their options. But, you know, I saw him once in our port, never again. I don't know what the rest of his story was. Is.
I'm wondering if there's some ways to use this model in other constituencies. For example, I'm thinking of the training programs in culinary arts in the central cities that then use their new graduates to staff and manage a restaurant, which then brings in funds from the public that patronizes the restaurant that then supports the school. And I'm wondering if you've seen some other models like this where it's a self-sustaining ministry, free of the grant writing cycle.
Not exactly totally free, but everything is relative. And yes, I've seen practice of New Start congregations that go into a neighborhood where the church wants to start a new congregation and says, what's missing from this community? I remember one in a suburb of Tampa where they decided what was missing was a photocopy center. And so they started one in the church office. And it brought tons of people in and out of the church building. One of the oldest such practices for churches has been daycare centers, right? That sometimes are a drain on the congregation, sometimes are a... It isn't easy. I mean, you have to have the same discipline as any business owner would when you're trying to use the entrepreneurial model. And that involves a certain amount of accountability from the employees or volunteers. I've fired volunteers as well as employees for not being accountable to good customer service, you know, for example. But I think the church in general, I'm a big advocate for the entrepreneurial model in the delivery of a wide range of services. The difference when you do it in the nonprofit world is you can earn a profit. The IRS doesn't mind you earning a profit. It's supposed to be with services that are related to your mission. So we went through a three-year nightmare with the IRS. Some of the local businesses that resented are beginning to offer services to the crew, phone calls, cheaper, you know. They complained to the IRS, so the IRS came in, and eventually the lawyer we hired, who had been an IRS agent and worked with us for 3 or 4 years, said to me at the end of the whole case, he said, I have never seen an IRS agent get a story more wrong than this one got with you guys. So this should have never happened to you. But anyway, I learned a lot from it. And one of the things is that, you know, is the sale of your services related to the fulfillment of your mission? IRS doesn't actually care if a church owns a bar and profits from that bar, but that is not generally not going to be related to your mission unless you make a pretty strong counseling case out of it or something. Not going to be related to the fulfillment of your mission. So you have to pay income taxes on that, corporate income tax, the way any business would. In our case, we didn't pay taxes on our store or our phone calls, because we were able to successfully make the case eventually that these were functions related to the fulfillment of our mission. So that's one of the issues you run into on the entrepreneurial application. But there are a million, you know who's really good on this is Tony Campolo. And he talks about going into the inner cities and starting businesses. I remember him talking about moving businesses, which are basically just labor and a truck, for example. All right, before we run out of time, could you
just quick? Kind of a random comment that makes it just opens up a whole other window of thinking, well, why wouldn't all corporations have a mission and be held accountable to it?
Like, well,
what a world would that be if all entrepreneurial activity was tied to a mission for the common good?
For the common
good.
Just
a random little parenthetical.
Yes, and many of the best for-profit organizations do have missions, and they work centered around those missions. In the case of a nonprofit, the IRS reviews your mission and agrees that it's for the common good, as opposed to for the profit, right. Now, I want to honor the commitment I made earlier to say, why do I think this is good for the church? And I've already pointed to the fact that you get raw contact with people of really strong faith. I've also said that it gives us ecumenical opportunity. I love something that Alexia Salvatierra said this afternoon, that she believes our churches are filled with people of compassion, who feel with. We are a compassionate people. But then what we lack is vision. Jesus had the vision to see what the needs of people were. Maritime ministry is one of the hardest places to have the vision. You and I depend on seafarers every day and never think about it. 90% of international commerce travels by sea. And on all of those ships, some human beings got to leave home, support their, to staff those ships. So we depend on them every day and never think about them. And whether you're landlocked or not, you can evolve a relationship with the maritime ministry by contacting NAMA or contacting your denomination, or if you happen to be blessed by living in a seaport, going down to the docks and seeing what's there. And establishing some ecumenical cooperation, which in itself is a gift to the church, that we far too rarely actually take advantage of or exploit. The seafarers offer us a bigger worldview, which is something that people outside the United States are desperate for us to grow. I'll be talking more about that this week. If there's a underlying theme to my sessions this week and next week, it is blind, it's not written down anywhere, I think, but it's blind spots among fools for Christ. And maritime ministry is definitely one. Tomorrow I'll talk about Israel-Palestine as another one. It's a multicultural experience. I love the early in my experience, we had this volunteer named Dottie, who was middle-aged, middle-class, Episcopalian, had her own real estate business, and she was a good example of a large group of people in South Florida who I call confirmed monolinguists, people who are determined never to speak more than English, you know, which in South Florida takes a lot of determination, because you know, Spanish is increasingly the dominant language there. And so Dottie came to us as a confirmed monolinguist. And she would work at our counter with these seafarers day in and day out. And after about 6 months, she said to me one day, you know what, working here kind of makes me want to take a Spanish class. And I said, that's part of our ministry too, is that we have seeded you with enough desire to reach beyond your native cultural experience, to relate to people of a different cultural experience. The ELCA once produced a little video about maritime ministry in which they tried to make a case that it's the best training ground for door-to-door evangelism. That if you work in a maritime ministry among people of all faiths, and seafarers being lonely people are eager to find someone to talk to, you can't help but get into situations where you're invited to share, and share your faith. This is not in a combative or competitive kind of way, like you might find yourself doing with the local Seventh-day Adventist or who knocks on your door, but people of Hindus or Muslims or all kinds of people who are just eager for the chance to talk with you. And when they say to you, why do you do this? Or what do you believe? It actually provides very good training to go into an increasingly secularized society and learn how to talk about our faith, which we don't do very well. We don't know how to do. Multi-faith, multicultural. Kathleen, go ahead.
Well, can I just interrupt there for a second? I guess I totally see what you're saying, except I would hope that nobody's trying to make a Hindu into a Christian.
No, exactly. Right. I heard your concern about that earlier, and I share it. But a Hindu may be very curious to understand, what do you believe? So
sure.
I can share my belief. You know, it is not, frankly,
sure,
my belief that a good practicing Hindu needs to become a Christian. That's just my view of Christian theology. But I can still talk about why Christianity matters to me.
Sure.
In a way, and why it calls me to welcome the stranger, or to provide hospitality, to care for other people and their needs without needing the self-reinforcement that comes from them mimicking my. Now, you know, in the maritime ministry world, you got all kinds. And,
well, you said there were two camps.
Yeah, and so
me, that's
the other camp.
To me is the height of disrespect.
Right.
It really bothers me a lot.
Right.
You know.
Well, it's out there.
I know.
And so if you, but I mean, I don't think you can fight it so much as you can provide an alternative. And we had people coming into our port who had come from a port where they had been heavily proselytized. And that was hard, you know, so then they would be nervous with us. Well, what, you know, are you here to sell me on your understanding of Jesus? And what a honor it was, really, to be able to say to them, do you want to, you know, do you need transportation to go shopping? What do you want? Now, they're nervous because the other camp, as we're calling it here, would share stories about how do you trick people to get them into the chapel where you can teach them about Jesus. You know, we'll take you shopping, but first you got to come and go inside the building here, and then you get inside the building, there's a chapel, and you got to sit there and you got to listen to a talk. And I had a man, Ling Zhao, Chinese man. Most of the Chinese work as group. Chinese are an increasingly large number of seafarers in the world, seafaring population. Generally, they go as groups, and there's always a political officer on board whose job it is to protect the cultural exposure of the crew, you know. And so the political officer would be the one who spoke English and would travel with the group everywhere, and you'd have to go through them and they would interpret what they were seeing. And Ling Zhao was working on a ship of Pakistanis, and we had our ship visitor. The ship sailed in. This was before 9/11, and Pakistanis were able to get off the ship, which they wouldn't be able to now. And our ship visitor went on board, posted some literature about us, and the minute Ling Zhao was off duty, he called our bus, came over to the center, he walked in. Maria had just gone home. I was packing up my bags. The center was going to stay open till late, but I was going home for the night. And he walked into the chapel, didn't see anybody, came out. My office was right next door, and he came right into my office and he said, can I talk to you about Christianity? I said, sure. And he sat down, and I talked to him for about an hour and a half, and then by God's grace, Peter, that Dutch-speaking volunteer that you saw in the film, he and his wife came in. They're from Canada, and they would come down every winter and spend 10 weeks volunteering with us, and they would say it was the highlight of their year. They just loved it. Mm. They loved seafarers. So Peter and Jenny walked in about that moment, and I said, I need to go home. You know, will you? And so they talked him into the night, and before he left, he wanted to get baptized. He said, he came to me the next day and said, will you baptize me? And I said, sure. Now, I've had correspondence with him since, and I warned him after we baptized him that the Christian world is wide and varied, and he would see many different kinds of Christians. And tried to prepare him for that, and he's sent me stories. Where people wanted to rebaptize him, and he wanted to know whether, you know, what was the reasoning behind that. So we can't prevent other people's practice of what they think Christianity should be about, but we can give good, we can't pour our energy into witnessing what we think is the best possible practice. And I think when you do that, well, one of the things that they offer us, of course, is a profound gratitude. When you, seafarers know that they are invisible to the communities that they serve, and that nobody cares about them or knows about them or sees them. And when you reach out and welcome people that are ignored or invisible to everyone else, they just respond in a hugely gratifying manner. Mm. And that is good. You know, we, people, when they get connected to a maritime ministry, they love it because it's so gratifying. And then there's the whole issue of just providing help. It is a good experience to help someone. And it strengthens your own experience of the faith and strengthens your living into the baptismal call to be a minister. So I recommend it to you whether you live in a port or not. My godmother in St. Paul, Minnesota, developed a great relationship with Seafarer's House and would sponsor programs for the Sunday school that would talk about who seafarers were and how the group was dependent on them. And then twice a year, they would all cook a bunch of cookies or collect National Geographics. One of the most common things that port chaplains distributed are National Geographics. Mm. We never had enough National Geographic magazines, because no matter what your language, you can look at those pictures. And seafarers actually travel the world and see. I mean, they know a lot more about the regions being photographed than most of us do. A last question?
In these days, when they're tightening immigration, is it more and more difficult for them to get off the boat?
Good question. And I'll come back to it in just a second. You remind me of another point I want to make, which is that there are two factors putting stress on the lives of seafarers. One is technology. Technology has driven the maritime industry to turn around ships faster and faster. It used to be that port chaplains, there's a Lutheran one in New York, they were all in the hotel business. They would all offer rooms because crew members would, they didn't fly in to meet the ship, and the minute they got off the ship, fly out. So they would sign on to the ship or sign off the ship, and they would need they'd need transient housing for a while. Seafarers spend 1/9 as much time in port today as they did 25 years ago. Mm. The ships turn around real fast because ships make money going from port to port, not sitting in a port. Mm. So that technology and the drive to automate more of the ship, and I don't think you'll ever have fully automated ships, but there are fewer crew on board, and that's hard on a cargo ship. Doesn't happen on a cruise ship, of course, but that's a different world, different story. We served both kinds. Mm-hmm. Security-wise, it is dramatic after 9/11. The increased numbers of crew who are not allowed off the vessel, and the suspicion with which all crew are viewed. There's great debates inside the world of port chaplains and efforts by port chaplains to talk to Coast Guard and other immigration authorities and say, listen, these people are our best allies for being eyes and ears at sea about what's going on that shouldn't be going on. And don't alienate them by treating them all as suspect. But the truth is, if you're from any one of a number of countries, it is up to the whim of the immigration officer who boards that vessel whether to allow you to come ashore or not. And if you've spent all this time crossing the ocean, and you just want, and in a building where you never leave work, you live where you work, which is a huge influence and a big humming engine that vibrates all the time. You just want to put your feet on land. You want to get off the vessel. And if you can't, you resent the authority that has prevented you. It's also forcing port chaplains to take more of our ministry to the ships and be less tied to a hospitality center on land. So it's a huge issue. Another dimension of it is the TWIC cards. Ports are all over the country are struggling with how to identify legitimate workers inside the port. And the ports are trying to seal off and make sure that only those people who have a legitimate need to come to be in the port come in and out. And they are really struggling with that. We could do a whole session just on the struggles they face there. And it is not it's not a priority for the authorities to think about how to help port chaplains come in and out of ports. So the
is your facility inside the port facility?
In our case, it was. In cases like Houston, the port is spread over 60 miles of river, and so there are a lot of private terminals. In our case, there was a government. It was interesting. Port Everglades built its reputation as one of the fastest growing cruise capitals of the world on its access to the airport, and it's open at nature as a port. Some ports are off in the middle of nowhere and they're just easy to seal off. Port Everglades built its whole reputation on being open until 9/11 happened, and then all of a sudden, what do you do about the fact that we're open? You know, and this sudden concern. There is a lot of, I think, legitimate concern that the point of greatest vulnerability to terrorist attack in the United States is through seaports, dirty bombs coming in a container, just like drugs come in. And it's impossible to stop it all. Why not the other end? Al-Qaeda actually has quite a fleet of ships now. One last item that, you know, we have young children and kids are fascinated by stories of piracy, right? And my son got in trouble with some of his teachers because he insisted that piracy was still going on, still a problem. And you know, his teachers and classmates would tell him that's old, but it's not. There's a great resurgence of piracy going on in the world, and some good articles have been written in Atlantic Monthly or Harper's, The New Yorker.
Try sailing your yacht by Somalia.
Yeah.
Exactly. There's a well-publicized example. The worst situation actually is in the Molucca Straits off of Indonesia, where whole oil tankers go missing. There's actually a lot of bone-chilling stories about it, but I am already overextended your time. So I'll be happy to stay if anyone wants to, but we are encouraged in these sessions to offer those who planned on a 50-minute session to get up and leave at a point like this. So thank you for your attention
you.
To an invisible ministry of the church.